Everyone's leader officially endorses Ibrahim Raisi as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. The Afghan army urges civilians to evacuate the besieged capital of Helmand province. Government forces are preparing for a major offensive against the Taliban. Turkish firefighters continue battling raging wildfires in the country's south, and that a week after they engulfed 3 coastal towns. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has endorsed Ibrahim Raisi as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. Any president-elect in Iran needs to be confirmed by the leader to proceed to presidency.
After winning the presidential election in June, Ibrahim Raisi now receives the presidential mandate from leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And this means Raisi is endorsed by the leader to be the new Iranian president. The decree was read out during the ceremony. It contains instructions and guidelines by Ayatollah Khamenei about major issues the president needs to address in his tenure. During the ceremony, Ayatollah Khamenei hoped the new administration will solve the existing economic problems in the country. Former President Hassan Rouhani handed over power to his successor with a pile of incomplete political and economic tasks on the table, from snowballing inflation to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. Ibrahim Raisi vowed to adopt a better approach toward those issues, a new approach that would remove U.S. sanctions and improve people's livelihood.
Change is what our people demand from the new government, and this change is inevitable. People's livelihood has been damaged, and they have lost their trust in the government because of the economic woes. My administration will try to lift sanctions, but we will not tie people's livelihood to the West.
Raisi won the 13th presidential election by a landslide on June 18th. He is affiliated with the Principalist Camp, which adopts a hard line regarding the U.S. and believes negotiations with American officials would be futile, since they're not trustworthy.
Under the Iranian constitution, any president-elect needs to have the endorsement of the leader before assuming office. Without it, their presidency would be null and void. And now that Raisi is granted the leader's mandate, he will take the next step and will be sworn in as the new president on Thursday. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's new president, Ibrahim Raisi, has promised to rebuild public trust and bridge the gap between the government and people during his tenure.
What has caused the most problems, in addition to the harm inflicted to people's livelihoods and businesses, is the damage to public trust. People sought a government to repair this damage, to restore their trust and narrow the gap with the government. A good relationship between the government and people can resolve problems.
Raisi made a comment after being confirmed as the 8th Iranian president. He said that the nation demanded change, justice, and an end to corruption through their vote in the June 18th presidential election. Raisi added that change is necessary and inevitable, and his government plans to make it happen. He called on the elites, officials, and people to play their part and help him do that. The 61-year-old president has noted that he'd certainly try to get U.S. sanctions removed, but he wouldn't tie to people's livelihoods and economy to that aim. Political commentator Fuad Izzati believes that the incoming president will try his best to remove all the sanctions imposed on Iran.
You know, I think he's going to be interested in getting sanctions relief, given the difficulties that Iran's economy faces, and a portion of those difficulties are due to sanctions. But as he said today, he's not going to tie people's well-being or economic condition to an agreement in Vienna or some other European city. So he's going to have a two-track approach to economy, it seems. One track is trying to improve the economy based on the things are right now, and with the assumption that sanctions will continue to exist. So that's going to be one track. The other track is going to be basically trying to remove sanctions without submitting to justified demands from the United States. And he's not going to be as flexible as the Rouhani administration when it comes to talks with the Western governments within P5 plus one or P4 plus one. He's going to be interested in reaching an agreement, but he's not going to give more concessions than the previous concessions have not resulted in much useful outcomes for the Iranian people.
Iran's top military commander says any response to the Israeli acts of aggression against the Islamic Republic would be open and forthright.
It goes without saying that the acts of mischief by the Zionist regime will certainly not go unanswered. But if the Islamic Republic does give a response, it will claim responsibility for it with absolute courage and declare it openly.
Bahrain dismissed Israeli, U.S. and U.K. allegations that Iran was behind a recent deadly attack on an Israeli-managed vessel off the coast of Oman. The general said whenever Israel suffers a setback, the regime and its allies rush to make accusations against Iran without any proof or investigation. The top commander stressed that Israel itself is responsible for the consequences of its actions. Bahrain said it's a bit natural that Israel would receive a response from those it has targeted and oppressed. The U.S. and U.K. have joined Israel in accusing Iran of an attack on an Israeli tanker off the coast of Oman last Thursday. The U.S. has threatened with a collective response. Tehran has strongly denied any involvement in the attack, calling the allegation unfounded. An informed source also said that Iran will give a crushing response to any measure to be taken against its interest and security.
On Thursday, an Israeli-managed oil tanker came under attack off the coast of Oman. The Liberian-flagged and Japanese-owned vessel, dubbed Mercer Street, was reportedly on its way from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, to Fujairah in the United Arab Emirates when it was targeted. In a statement on Friday, Zodiac Maritime, the Israeli-owned firm managing the oil tanker, said that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. In recent months, several other Israeli-managed ships have come under attack on various maritime routes across the world. Israel was quick to accuse Iran of carrying out the attack, pushing for a United Nations action against Tehran. This is while Iran has denied any involvement in the attack. But that's ironic, as the regime has had more UN resolutions imposed against it than the rest of the world combined.
You know, hypocrisy in the international scene is not is nothing new, and we are all familiar with that. That's one point of view. Make some alliance against Iran to make it politicize actually the situation and take it to the Security Council of the United Nations to put more pressure on Iran to force the next administration to go to the negotiation table over the nuclear issue, and they hope for further talks on regional issues or missile programs, such things, but it doesn't seem to work like that, actually.
The United States and the United Kingdom have joined Israel in hurling the accusation at Iran without providing any corroborative evidence.
The allegations against Iran come despite Israel's repeated hostile actions against Iran over the past months, from attacks on a dozen Iranian tankers to the assassination of nuclear scientists. The question is why the West keeps silent on those actions and then instead targets Iran on groundless allegations.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that Washington is confident that Iran conducted the attack on the empty Mercer Street and vowed, quote, an appropriate response. Blinken has also stated that there will be a collective response against Iran. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab also said UK assessments had concluded that it was highly likely that Iran used one or more drones to carry out the deadly attack.
Forcing their ally in the region, which is actually the regime created, actually manufactured by them in the many decades ago. So it is natural that they would support that and they want to put pressure on Iran. We know that we are in a time of transition of power in Iran. President Raisi is going to actually take office in upcoming days. And this time is a time that they think that there can be some let's say, uncertainty in the government and power in Iran. So they're trying to put pressure on the next administration, actually.
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, however, has warned against any possible act of adventurism against country's interests, pledging an immediate, powerful, and serious response to any such move. A source close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that threats issued by Western officials and Israel are considered more of a propaganda gesture. The source, however, vowed any move against Iran's interests and national security will be met with Tehran's, quote, crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences. There are also unconfirmed reports that Israel has gotten the green light from the U.S. to go ahead with an attack that may involve targeting an Iranian port or vessel.
It is time of transition of power in Iran, but the Westerners think that this time of transition is affecting the military power and will of Iran. But the military and the armed forces are not under the president in Iran. And so that by the change of the administration, the policies or the vigilance of the armed forces would change.
If the report is true, it goes to show that London and Washington have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. But as Iranian officials have stressed, any possible aggression won't go unanswered.
The Yemeni army says it's made major advances in the central province of Al-Baida in the second phase of an operation dubbed Nasr al-Mubin. Army spokesman General Zaria said that a vast swath of land was liberated from Saudi-backed militants during the four-day operation. He said that the army and its allied Ansarullah forces also took control of the strategic Agabat al-Ghanza Heights in Naman district. He added that the Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists also suffered heavy losses in the operation. At least 160 terrorists were killed and 200 more got wounded. Dozens of them were also captured. The Yemeni army has recently intensified its attacks to liberate Marib province, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. The Nasr al-Mubin operation was launched last month to facilitate the army's advances toward Marib. The Afghan army has urged civilians to evacuate the besieged provincial capital of Helmand province. The government is preparing a major offensive against the Taliban militants there. A senior general saying that evacuation would pave the way for the army to start its operation in the city of Lashkargah. The Taliban are reported to have already taken hold of the city. The UN says at least 40 civilians have been killed amid fierce fighting. The world body also warned that indiscriminate gunfire and air raids are hurting Afghan civilians the most. Taliban militants have stepped up attacks across the country since May. They've seized a large swath of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They're now focusing on capturing provincial capitals. Now, in the meantime, Russian and Uzbek troops are holding joint military drills close to the Afghan border. The exercises kicked off in southeastern Uzbekistan. Moscow is saying that 1,500 Russian and Uzbek forces taken part in the five-day maneuvers. And this is amid fears of the spillover of the Afghan conflict into Central Asia. Russian and Uzbek forces will also begin trilateral exercises in Tajikistan near the Afghan border on Thursday. Now in Turkey, firefighters keep battling wildfires in the south a week after they engulfed the three coastal towns. Authorities say that thousands of firefighters, backed by planes and choppers, are on duty. Several countries, including Iran, have sent firefighting planes to put out the flames. Eight planes have been confirmed dead. Officials say the blazes were fanned by temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius, strong winds, and low humidity. The heat wave exacerbated the fires after months of exceptionally dry weather in Turkey's southwest. The wildfires are the worst the country has seen in a decade. Rashan Saglam joined us a short while ago, and She updated us on the raging fires that are wreaking havoc across southern Turkey.
More than 5,000 firefighters were dispatched to the areas of fires to fight those wildfires. Also 16 planes, 9 drones, 52 helicopters, as well as 129 fire trucks and 57 ambulances. There are two scenarios for what's happening. The first scenario is that those fires happen naturally due to the heat, because in southeast Turkey and south Turkey now the temperature is almost 40 degrees. Sometimes it goes up to 42 degrees. The other scenario that the government hinted to, and also Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, the foreign minister, also hinted about, is that those fires were man-made. And we've seen a video of three people calling themselves the Sons of Fire, saying that they are responsible for this and that this is a terrorist attack against Turkey and the Turkish government. Now, Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, the foreign minister, said earlier that after the investigation is done, we will reveal all the circumstances. Also, in Ankara, two people were arrested on allegations of starting a fire. This is devastating for Turkey, for the economy in the country. And as I mentioned, that tourists are trying to leave.
The Chinese city of Wuhan, where COVID-19 emerged for the first time, will test its entire population because the virus has made a comeback. Authorities there are saying that all the 11 million residents will swiftly be tested. On Monday, the city logged 7 COVID infections among migrant workers. They were the first local cases identified in more than a year after Wuhan brought the outbreak under control. Other Chinese cities have also rolled out mass testing as an outbreak of the Delta variant is quickly spreading. People in affected areas have been confined to homes too. On Tuesday, China reported 61 domestic infections. Iran has reported some 39,000 new coronavirus infections. That's the highest since the pandemic started in this country last year. The new figure pushes total caseload to 4 million. Health officials also registered 378 more related deaths in one day. And that pushes the death tally to 91,800. The Delta strain of the disease, which first emerged in India, is blamed for the rising cases in Iran. And that despite the recent tough measures taken by the National Virus Task Force to stem the virus. The measures include the closure of government offices and banks for a number of days. The restrictions also include a ban on road travel to and from a number of hotspot cities. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to head of UK's immigration enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge received or settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport EU citizens. We're prepared for you an article written by Mark Townsend under the heading EU citizens who applied to stay in Britain facing threat of deportation. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from UK ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of the Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge received or settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office in recent days, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Friday, 30th of July, an EU citizen whom the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union settlement scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national, who requested anonymity, told the Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." P. Pierre Maclouf, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain EU nationals, perhaps believing that they are easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures." Pierre Maclouf said, "Whether this is due to administrative or willful neglect may be unclear, but by ignoring the legal steps that EU nationals have undertaken to assert their rights, the United Kingdom is in breach of its duties under the withdrawal agreement." The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of forwarded digitally. Aranea Kugulathas, a barrister and legal manager of Bail for Immigration Detainees, European Economic Area Project, said paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison who found it difficult to access a computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals. Aranea Kugulathas, a barrister and legal manager of Bail for Immigration Detainees, European Economic Area Project, said, "Despite having made applications, settled status applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation." She added, "These challenges are particularly difficult for those detained under immigration powers in prisons, some of whom are locked in their cells for around 23 hours a day or more due to the pandemic. Aware of such difficulties, ministers have promised an indefinite period where people who had not applied would be allowed to do so if they had reasonable grounds." Among the cases known to Bail for Immigration Detainees are one where the Home Office failed to acknowledge a settled status application submitted in mid-July, stating that there were no barriers to his removal and removal directions are to be set soon. Another case involved a European Union citizen who, despite submitting a settled status application online, still received removal directions from the Home Office. A UK Home Office spokesperson rejected the charges as baseless and, despite a number of cases featured in the article, have been contested by the Home Office in immigration tribunals, the latest of which occurred on Friday, 30th of July. Claimed the Observer had failed to provide any proof whatsoever that detention or removal directions are being served to those with settled status, to those with EUSS settlement scheme status. They claimed, "Our approach means that should immigration enforcement encounter anyone with EUSS but who may be eligible, we will work with them to enable them to apply and signpost them to available support. If someone has applied to the European Union settlement scheme by 30th of June deadline but has not had a decision yet, their rights are protected until their application is decided."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grimmen Prez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world, and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroyed the Middle East. Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening, and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic, because it is a lot to digest. Mm.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited. Mm-hmm. And it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today without watching this film is like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
Of course,
film
that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did. And he used the 90 minutes extremely well. Because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I walk away with, what was the impact? The impact was, I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
And why was that?
Yeah. Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high-profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come onto the into the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds more, it adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
Mm. I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multimillion dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
Mm-hmm. So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned the study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this million-dollar contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. And I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
After watching this documentary, really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Maria, what was your reaction to watching the connections being made between the U.S. military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world, as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it, because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity, and it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer it lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling, and you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy, because he does everything via Twitter, and he makes, you know, he has the biggest arms deal, and put that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all of those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising, but not, because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
Mm-hmm. And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, the doc, into three parts. part one was the arrant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history. And I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached, at the start of the transatlantic slave trade. Because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization. But this was the first time it was actually industrialized. Mm-hmm. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, spent 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, you know, dozens of other places I've been, and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. You know, especially having done it for 20 years, it, you know, yeah. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark, schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down. And they try to gag them. Mm. And that's appalling, and it shouldn't happen, but it does, and it's still happening today.
Mm. And it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep this sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that?
Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything. They're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage, It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... The African National Congress. Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in New Labour and was, the spiritual light here who's going to bring all this hope. And yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and we had Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud... having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him, and he said, no, you need to stop this, otherwise we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round, and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less. That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it, but then he was, Teflon Toda, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, which is, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
The documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. The thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Fiscal year 1999, 2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, 1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify? What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh during that clip. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew he could get away with it. And he has. It was the one that was then ostracised and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? What can we do?
And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, the funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of a, I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behaved literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that they could, he could pull her leash in at any time he wanted, and sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult, but I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he's associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically. Because we knew all this, but when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
so, just a final thought on the film.
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place. Which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, that people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Ruth, very powerful note to end it on, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.